Hey, it's Mina. If you enjoy listening to this podcast, click the subscribe button so you don't miss any new episodes. Also, please take a minute to rate the show and leave a review. Keep in mind that my mom reads all of them. Before we get to today's episode, I want to tell you about some other great ESPN podcasts. First, there's my daily show, ESPN Daily, where we bring you the most interesting story in sports every day in about 20 minutes. Also, on the latest episode of That's What She Said with Sarah Spain, Sarah talks to five-time NFL Executive of the Year Scott Pioli about his enduring friendship with Bill Belichick and what it's like to be married to Bill Parcells' daughter. Plus, the end of the college football season means the beginning of NFL draft season, and the First Draft podcast with Mel Kiper Jr. and Todd McShay is back with new episodes every Wednesday leading up to the draft in Vegas. Download and subscribe to ESPN Daily. That's What She Said with Sarah Spain and First Draft wherever you get your podcasts. Hello. Welcome back to the Mina Kimes Show featuring Lenny. The only NFL podcast where one of the hosts is quietly relieved that the Seahawks are eliminated because it means the other host is going to be a lot less moody and yell a lot less.
Wow. That would
be Lenny. Joined today by my fellow depressed Seahawks fan. We're not going to talk Seahawks, I promise.
I'm over it.
You're over it? Okay, that's Chris Sproul, folks. He wasn't mentioned in the read, but he's one of the other hosts of First Draft Podcast. We're going to talk about the NFC Championship today. Then later in the show, his co-host Mel Kiper Jr., you might have heard of him, also whose team lost, by the way, is going to come on to talk about the AFC Championship, which I kind of think is going to be a better game. I don't know. We'll see what Chris has to say about that. We're going to talk about Niners-Packers and all of the things that go into that. But is there anything you'd like to get off your chest first about our loss?
Our loss, collective, to all 12s out there. I mean, it was a tough loss. I mean, really, it was week 17 combined with that,
yeah.
Which is this halted brilliance by Russell Wilson. And there's a part of you that goes, well, that's okay. They need to make some obvious fixes. They have some things to shore up on the defensive side of the ball, on the O-line, as usual. And Russ will be back next year. And then there's another part of you that goes, as we're seeing with Aaron Rodgers this year at age 36, where it's like, if you have a brilliant quarterback performing at the peak of his awesome powers, you don't want to waste those seasons. So, you know, to have Russell Wilson playing like he was, kind of in all facets, stealing yards with his legs, not taking hits in a kind of genius-like way that Watson and Jackson and Mahomes all need to watch, and to see it come short. It's a bummer.
That's it. That's the end of the Seahawks talk. Well, we're going to talk about the Packers and, I guess, vis-a-vis the Seahawks, but I feel the same way. After the Super Bowl, at some point, I'm going to do kind of post-mortems on a bunch of the teams, and Seattle and Baltimore, all those teams will fall into that. But credit where credit's due. Aaron Rodgers looked really good in this game. And ahead of it, Bill, Jesus, I spent so much time talking to Bill Barnwell now. It's like when you start calling everyone your dog's name or your husband's name.
Don't call me Lenny.
You wish. I said it was entirely plausible he would put together a much better game, quarter, half, whatever, than he has all season, and that was the case. That said, he had a lot of help from the Seahawks defense, right? I mean, at one point I saw Davante Adams, I think, had more separation than any wide receiver in the here it is. Here's a stat. It's from Next Gen Stats. He was open, which they classify as 3 yards of separation, on 64% of his targets on Sunday. That's his highest rate ever. So, you know, on one hand, I want to give Rodgers for credit for, you know, he was throwing deep, he was taking risks, he was throwing into tight windows, he was doing all the things he hasn't done in the second half of the season. But on the other hand, Seattle's defense is very bad.
Yeah, on the case of the acquittal of Davante Adams as a deep threat, the Seattle defense is being called as an expert witness on the part of the defense of Davante Adams. I mean, you know, the fake rub route. Oh, that's really cool.
Oh, but man, I don't want to relive it.
These are great throws to a wide open receiver. So both of those things can be true. One of them is an indictment on the defense. One of them is a compliment for Aaron Rodgers.
Yes. And some of them are great that the one to Davante on third down on the final drive that iced the game before the Jimmy Graham, right? The up the sideline. So on one hand, somehow Ugo Amadi, who has never started an NFL game, I believe, Seahawks rookie, was defending Devontae, who, by the way, they were able to, well, I'll talk about that in a second, to get whatever matchup they wanted. But on the other hand, it was a perfect throw by Rodgers, right? Like, even with the coverage and all of that, his touch on deep passes in this game looked better than it has all year, Chris.
It did, but, you know, he's got a game coming up against a team where he was unable to complete a deep pass. And I really think it speaks to Devontae Adams just being really open, knowing that that's the guy you have to cover. I mean, it's just the flaws with the Seattle Seahawks.
We're not talking about the Seahawks, but
on the season,
about the
we're exposed in that game. And there's no way around that. And it's a credit to the Packers that they did that. Credit to their coaches. And certainly a credit to Rodgers, who's had the classic regression season, right. But he's got a tough one coming up.
It's interesting because Devontae Adams was really—I don't have his target percentage in me, but he was pretty much it in this game,
yes.
Right? Which is always the criticism, or has been the criticism of the Packers all season. That after Adams, it's like, well, you know, you could throw some screens to Aaron Jones, but and obviously Alan Lazard got hurt, but you know. Even with that, it's always amazing to me when you're looking at an offense where everyone knows the ball is going to go to one guy and the defense still can't figure out how to handle them. Now, some of that is the lack of talent in Seattle. Some of that is bad coaching. I mean, at some point, I thought they were going to double team and whatever. And then another credit, and this is more to the Packers, and I think thinking through how they're going to play San Francisco's defense in this matchup, LaFleur did a great job scheming him open. You know, ton of pre-snap motion in this game. Rodgers was money on play action. I think on the first touchdown, I believe that was off of play action to Devontae Adams and just killed Bradley McDougal. But in any case, I thought LaFleur did a terrific job with some fairly limited personnel.
He did, and I think he was matched by some fairly limited personnel in key spots on the Seattle side of the ball. Again,
let's San Francisco. Talk about that. Talk about what you saw from the Packers offense and how you think they match up with San Francisco. So just so that we're not dwelling in the depressing.
Well, let's just think about it this way. I mean, this is the thing I can't get over, and work with me on this analogy, but this is the couple that broke up, you know, like 4 weeks ago, and we're saying, and they get back together and you kind of go, oh, that's not going to work out. And then you realize, like, of course it's not going to work out. You guys just broke up. All the flaws in your relationship are so obvious. Now, Green Bay went to San Francisco again, basically a little over 4 weeks ago, and got absolutely trucked, 37-8.
Demolished.
And so our job here, if we choose to accept it, is to try to talk ourselves back into this relationship. But again, I can't get that breakup out of my head. And I don't know where you are on this one. I mean, Kyle Shanahan's doing his damnedest to try to do it. He's saying, don't be that stupid. Don't buy into 37-8. But everything about that 37-8 looks somewhat repeatable. Probably not so much, not by such a margin, 29 points. And the funniest thing about that, and I have some stats to back it up, is D4 didn't even play in that game.
That's the other thing. It's like, okay, I'm going to try to talk myself into this. I'm going to say, hey, Rodgers looked better.
You guys broke up, and you didn't even know about his gambling addiction.
This Niners defense is healthy now, right?
Yes.
Like, this is way worse. I mean, here are some numbers from the first game. Rodgers, 0-7 on 10-yard plus passes.
104 yards, Mina.
3.2 yards per attempt.
Playing from behind.
0-14 on third down. I don't have the numbers in front of me, but I believe he was 45-32 on third down against Seattle. It's an approximation. So, you know, I am not sure there's anything to be learned from this Seattle game that translates to the Packers game. And the other thing, by the way, about the Seattle game, even though Rodgers was very good throwing deep, he wasn't moving great.
Nope.
You know, he wasn't improvising in the way that he historically, that's sort of been his bread and butter. And my big takeaway from watching that Niners defense against Minnesota, if you can't move as a quarterback, good night. It's over.
Yeah. And, you know, one thing that really stands out to me here is that that first matchup, again, this was week 12. This wasn't week 2. It's not a different football team now. This is week 12. By the way, the Packers, after this game, won their next 5, so they figured something out, mm-hmm. and maybe they weren't a terrible team when they went into San Francisco. But again, in week 12,
pretty easy competition, but yeah.
Bosa and Ford weren't on the field together. And, you know, I went back and looked at a couple plays in this game. Very first drive of the game, Packers get the ball. They're deep in their own territory. And sure enough, it's like, oh, okay, here we go. Fred Warner gets a sack. Well, you look at that play. The San Francisco 49ers brought an extra defender. You know, Rodgers didn't see anything. The strip sack happens. Bosa lands on at the 5-yard line. Feels like ball game. Turned out to be ball game. You know what's funny, Mina? They don't have to bring 5. Ford and Bosa are getting home on 40% of dropbacks right now. Not sacks, but they're getting pressure on 40% of dropbacks when those two guys are on the field. This reminds me a little bit of what the Titans did. Well, you and I were talking on the side about the Titans and the Ravens. You're like, oh man, I wonder what Dean Pease did. You know, and it was like, no, he kind of simplified and Rashard Evans was awesome.
Well, that,
and we can't get away from the fact that sometimes when you have really good football players, you don't have to get exotic in the playoffs. And you've watched Pete Carroll for a long time, so you know that.
Yeah,
I had to get back there.
Let's relive the glory days back when the simplistic defense.
You get to watch Richard Sherman on Sunday. That's cool.
But yes, it's very simple, guys. Football's a numbers game, and if you can get pressure without sacrificing numbers, you're probably going to win on defense. And you certainly saw that in the Minnesota game because the Niners' defense I wrote this down somewhere. Hold on. Okay, so Kirk Cousins was pressured 46% of the time, which is bonkers.
Yikes.
He faced a 4-man rush 83% of the time. Like, they didn't have to get weird.
That's just Johnny's and Joe's.
Because Bosa and Ford were obliterating him. You know, as far as the Niners defense goes, and, did they look good. I mean, God, Dre Greenlaw was amazing in this game. I wrote his name like 300 times. He was just flying out there. Really, the only mistake they made was leaving Akella Witherspoon out there for too long. Right. And then they, you know, I certainly don't think they're going to make that mistake again. Other than that, once they got Emmanuel Moses excellent in there, I don't have a single criticism. I really don't. So I don't. And it is because of the health. I don't know what to say. Like, you know, during that stretch in the back half of the season when the Niners defense fell off, it was very clearly because of schedule and health, and their health was fixed.
Yeah.
So I don't know. I think, you know, Mahomes, if we get to that point and they win this game, it's going to be a different equation because he can move around. And I do believe you can beat them. You know, they only struggled this season with mobile quarterbacks and Matt Ryan, which was hilarious, but, other than that, though, I just don't know how you beat them.
Well, it's interesting, too, because the Seattle game at Green Bay mimicked a little bit the Seattle game against the 49ers where Russ just started stealing.
Yeah.
You know, and again, you bringing it back to Aaron Rodgers. Russell steal against a tired 4-man rush with an occasional blitzer and occasional spy in fourth quarters in games when they're on the chase. I don't know if you're. If it's a situation where Rodgers can feel like he's stealing it, he's not going to throw a lob to DK Metcalf. Man, I'm making this way too much about the Seahawks. But again, it is the comp. These teams have all played each other recently.
Yeah.
So you use that team as a prism. But I'm going to give you something else I don't really like about this Green Bay matchup. We've been talking about how Green Bay is going to score points. I don't like that Green Bay low-key is not good at stopping the run.
Let's talk about that.
When the San Francisco 49ers, they want to just run the ball. They want to take pressure. Keeping Bosa and Ford fresh. You know, these are tropes, but that's actually a little bit real as you get to week 18 and week 19 here. We saw a Texans defense that was being chased and they were absolutely exhausted and it wrecked them. You know, Mahomes went into cheetah mode and they just got tired. And I really think that's a risk for this Green Bay defense as well, because if Kyle Shanahan is on schedule, again, it's a trope, but it's real. It's winning offense. If Kyle Shanahan is on schedule, yikes, like Debo Samuel has come into play here a little bit more. you know, San Fran is just has low-key more weapons than you think, because you see Mostert run, pop off a run, and you're like, who's that guy? And you're like, oh, he looks good. And they have that throughout the offense right now.
Yeah. I feel like you and I need to have, like, a Goodwill Hunting, it's not your fault style moment about
it's not your fault.
Seahawks. But we'll do it another time.
Pick the wrench.
Well, I praise the Niners defense a lot, and yep. I basically said they have no flaws at this point, which is a bit of an overstatement. But so I'm gonna say something negative now to balance that and to make Packers fans feel better about this game. Jimmy Garoppolo was not good in the last game. Very early on, I texted someone, he wants to get picked. Like, he just kind of felt, you know, and Niners fans got mad at me, I think it was last week, for saying every couple games or so, Garoppolo just can't, like, stops reading underneath defenders, and it happened. And ultimately,
it didn't matter.
I
mean, he got baited there.
Yeah, totally. And it's something we've seen him do, frankly, all season. And that part of the field, by the way, is so important to Kyle Shanahan's offense off of play action. Like, if you can actually take that part of the field away from him or use it to your advantage against Garoppolo, you can really punish them. And then after that, Garoppolo threw it, like, twice, I think, the rest. Like, Kyle Shanahan just took the football out of his hands, and it's a credit to their run game that it doesn't matter.
Yeah. I mean, sometimes box scores lie, and sometimes they don't. But this game was 14-10 at halftime. It wasn't 21-3, and it ended up with, you know, 47 carries. Garoppolo threw the ball 19 times.
I mean, this is
Bill Parcells' Giants stuff here, and it worked, and it didn't feel that close in the fourth quarter.
My concern is also that the Packers defense is not as good as the Vikings defense, which
it's not.
Phew, boy. I mean, early in the game, Danielle Hunter worked Mike McGlinchey a couple times. And I was thinking, well, okay, we could get a good game here, you know, because I love this Vikings defensive line. And then as the game went on, I mean, the Niners offensive line, which I thought had the disadvantage in this matchup, really came together, right? Like, they've got a backup at center in Ben Garland. I pointed that as a potential issue because the Vikings in particular are so good at moving their pass rushers inside and exploiting matchups, but he held his own. Mike McGlinchey figured it out. I mean, if you can run the ball that much, that effectively, and the defense knows you're running it, your offensive line is probably pretty good. Now, some of it, obviously, it's Shanahan, so it's scheme and deception and all that, but I thought they were really impressive. Now, Green Bay comes to town, and what do you think is the strength of their defense, other than Za'Darius Smith?
It's the pass rush, and that's kind of, again, why I keep going back to, I don't know if these teams are that much different than that 37-8 game, because it's that pass rush.
Yeah.
And Kyle Shanahan, they do some really smart stuff. This isn't just, like, straight up outside zone run. They'll run at you in all kinds of different ways. They'll access their play action game in all kinds of different ways. And again, Jimmy Garoppolo, you know, he can throw that pass that can get him into trouble, but, you know, if they're able to access a lot of these second and fours and things like that, I just think it opens Kyle's game up enough. And you know, frankly, like, Jimmy Garoppolo had his playoff game. You know, maybe it's a cliche, but he might have settled down a little bit. We'll see if he's a little bit more confident coming into this one. Interesting. I just keep going back to San Francisco and where you're like, oh man, what's going to bite them? You know, they have the number 7 offense by DVOA. Their drive stats, they're, like, almost identical to Kansas City. Yikes. They have the number 2 defense by DVOA. Like, their special teams isn't great, but it's not a train wreck. Like, there isn't that fatal flaw that sticks out that where you're like, this team's just going to get bit. I think you pointed to it. I think it's probably if they're able to get under Garoppolo's skin. But again, like, if the 49ers are able to run the ball in this game, yikes.
How do you, I think, like, okay, so knowing that, right? And by the way, they ran it at some point. It was very obvious to Minnesota what the game plan was. Yeah. The Niners ran by design on 69% of their plays on Saturday, which is not only nice, but historic. That's the highest rate in 10 years in a playoff game. If you're the Packers, I mean, I just don't know if they have the personnel at linebacker in particular. to match up with that, frankly.
Well, it's not just that. It's that when you run, you know, what was the, you know, our friend Bill Barnwell has written about this kind of an appreciation for Gronk. When New England was using Gronk, they had like a great slot receiver who, oh, by the way, on running plays was blowing away a defensive end or just destroying a linebacker 2 and 3 yards downfield. By the way, George Kittle's doing that right now. So we talk about, oh, you know, they have a backup in its center. Yeah, but when you're running wide and George Kittle is just driving Daniil Hunter or Kendricks or somebody, like if he's driving them 3 and 4 yards down the field, you're stealing there. And then when you fake out of that and, oh, by the way, dump it off to George Kittle, who dominated the previous matchup. You know, you talk about your concerns about the Green Bay linebackers. Well, look what George Kittle did to him the first time. So, I mean, the fact that we've gotten this far, wow, we really like this advantage for San Fran. We haven't mentioned George Kittle's name yet, an All-Pro. Yikes.
Yeah, I know.
Honestly, Mina, it's like the challenge here, you know, it's high school debate. Talk me into Green Bay's path.
I'm trying to. I'm thinking through it. I mean, yeah, and with Kittle, you hit on it, which is, I mean, generally, honestly, with the Niners is that they've got like 3 or 4 guys on offense who can play 3 or 4 positions at the same time.
Right.
And you never know what they're going to do.
Super multiple.
And that would be Kittle, a Debo, right, who honestly could be a running back or tight end as well. The fullback, you know, Juszczyk. I'm always a little bit uncomfortable right before I say his name. But yeah, and also with the running backs too, like this was a Tevin Coleman game. Brady wasn't great. Like every other game, a different Niners running back ends up being the good one. But I think probably, you know, not to look ahead, but you know, your best bet is, well, it's interesting though, because in this season, like, do you think the Niners are more vulnerable in a grinded out game against a good defensive opponent, which I guess at this point, like Tennessee, or a shootout?
I think a little bit in terms of a shootout, in the sense that Kyle Shanahan doesn't want a situation where he feels unbalanced, where he feels like, you know, we've seen all the data, the new analytics that basically say play action works whether you run or not. But it doesn't mean in terms of his psyche, in terms of his play calling, like he wants to be able to keep that in the bag. And we see the ratios there. Again, like Dee Ford and Nick Bosa really fresh, and sometimes Dee Ford popping inside, they're doing, you know, 4 aces type stuff to get their pass rushers free. Like those guys are scary if they're tired. They're terrifying if they're really fresh late in game. So yeah, I think I'm probably speaking for any old ball coach here, but I think they're probably more vulnerable if they get into a shootout type situation. Because you keep going back and saying, is Jimmy Garoppolo going to do it when it's on him? And that's the question.
Right. And with the play action, I just think Shanahan really likes optionality on every single play, right? And you know, there's been games, by the way, where Jimmy Garoppolo has been phenomenal on third down. My point, whenever I criticize him, it's never to say, oh, Jimmy Garoppolo could lose this for them. I just mean there's been games.
Right.
It's not every game where he is inconsistent, especially, again, in that intermediate area of the field. So it's just a thing that can happen in any game with the San Francisco team. And I actually don't think, too, it's really dependent on script. Like, even when they're winning sometimes, he's just been inconsistent. As far as Bosa and that pass rush, I think, again, the reason why I feel mobile quarterbacks are, I wouldn't call them their weakness, but your best hope against them is he still over pursues sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
I think sometimes their defensive line plays super aggressively. Now, the development of Greenlaw, who I mentioned earlier, and the return of Quan Alexander helps with that a great deal. But I think if you can extend the play against them, I mean, this is true of any team, I think that's your best shot.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, you know, the other thing that can just pop up here is, you know, if you want to pick a category, San Francisco wasn't like a top 10 team, and they fumbled the ball 15 times this year. They had some giveaways. They gave the ball away 27 times. If you just want to like break a box score odd playoff team, how does a team lose 37-8 and then beat a team a few times a week later? Like, I mean, watch the first 10 minutes of Kansas City versus Tennessee, and then say your quarterback is Jimmy Garoppolo and not Patrick Mahomes and say that, of course you can lose playoff games like that. And you can lose them at home. If you have the best player on your team, arguably, or the best weapon on your team, fumbling punts at the 5-yard line, you can lose to anybody.
Right.
You know, ask the Patriots about the Dolphins, you know, so yeah, absolutely they can lose. I just think San Francisco's going to have to do some self-inflicted stuff
right.
because, you know, Bear Bryant speak here in terms of just like Johnny's and Joe's, like hat on hat. I don't think, again, back to the original point, these teams are that different than the teams that played in week 12. And by the way, there's Dee Ford. And by the way, you know, Jared Veldheer is out there. Shout out to Hillsdale College, my alma mater. But Jared Veldheer is out there. The guy was retired at the beginning of the year.
Yeah.
So, you know, Green Bay's had to do some duct taping on their own time in terms of, even though these teams are, you know, at this point in the season, relatively healthy. It's interesting. Mina, I pulled a stat. So if you beat a team by 25 points during the regular season, the last 10 times that has happened, this is ESPN Stats and Info, shout out, those teams have won. They've repeated that happen. The interesting thing here, point spread alert, it's by 8.4 points. So the blowout didn't happen. Generally speaking, these two teams, oh, they're playoff teams, and it kind of normalized, and it turned into a good football game. The average margin was 8.4 points, so, you know, a touchdown. So, of course, you expect a closer game. We're just trying to find a way to make up all those points.
So the formula for the Packers here, Jimmy Garoppolo has to throw a couple of interceptions.
Got
to
give him a win.
A couple weird special teams screw-ups. Rodgers has to look like he did last week and not like he did the second half of the season. Somebody other than Devontae Adams is going to have to make a few big plays, I think, in this one.
Jimmy G? The other Jimmy G? Who's it going to be?
I actually really like Lazard. I know he got hurt.
Yeah.
I've liked him all year, but I don't know, man. This is a tough one. I think I really, it's funny because I really like the Chiefs. I think they're the best team mm-hmm. at this point to me. But I think the AFC Championship is a lot more close than this one. Maybe I'm wrong.
I'm right with you. I was staring at this game. And by the way, again, you know, the other one, you know, who's going to beat you in the passing game? It could be Aaron Jones. I mean, Aaron Jones caught 49 passes this year.
I thought he was going to obliterate the Seahawks. Yep. Ended up being.
By the way, that was very Brooklyn of you. You still have it in you to be like, to drop Alan Lazard as an indie band that you liked before. Like, you're like, I knew Tame Impala in 2008.
I was into Alan Lazard before anyway. You know what? I was into him because when he had his first breakout game, I was like, oh, this guy's good. If he's good, that's some great fantasy team names are going to come out of this.
Yeah.
And then I ended up liking him a lot. All right. Before we get to the AFC Championship, we're going to take some questions from listeners. Thanks as always for your reviews. But before we get to that, I want to tell you guys about DraftKings. Can you believe it's conference championship week? Time's up for two of the teams playing this weekend, but you still have time to feed your fantasy fix with DraftKings, the leader in one-day fantasy football. Draft your lineup and feel the sweat like never before. Every run, throw, and catch means more with the DraftKings lineup. It's simple. Just draft your lineup, stay under the salary cap, and see how your team stacks up against the competition. Nothing adds to the sweat of watching the game quite like having a free shot at over $750,000 with your first deposit. Plus, for a limited time, all new and existing users can get a deposit bonus up to $500. That's some extra cash to play with throughout the playoffs. Download the DraftKings app now and use code MENA. For a limited time, both new and existing users can get a deposit bonus up to $500 on your next deposit. New users, be sure to enter code MENA during sign-up. And you'll also get a free shot at over $750,000 with your first deposit. That's code MENA, and you can get a deposit bonus up to $500 only at DraftKings. Minimum $5 deposit required. Deposit bonus requires a 25 times playthrough. Eligibility restrictions apply. See DraftKings.com for details.
Question. Question. Lenny, for your thoughts.
Ready to answer some questions with me, Chris?
Let's do this.
First question is from CHJHDCVBH.
That's my burner.
Well, this is kind of fun. If you were going to make a team out of just one player playing every position, so I guess you'd clone him, who would you pick? Modern era only, because otherwise it's just Jim Brown. Folks who come to mind, this is the answer I would give, George Kittle, Well, actually, maybe I wouldn't. Okay, George Kittle, Gronk, Cam Chancellor, Derrick Henry, Julius Peppers, Cam Newton, Kenny Easley, love that, Brian Urlacher.
I have a good one.
Okay.
And I wrote this story one time back in the day. Cam Newton, when he entered the draft, was 6'6", 250, had just absolutely eviscerated SEC defenses as a runner, led the conference as a runner, and as a passer. 6'6", 250 is like a good night at Ruth's Chris from Nick Bosa, and he's twitchy. He runs 4'6". You could easily fatten him up. I for this story, I talked to his JC coach at Midland in Texas, Mina, and he said, I wanted to put Cam at safety. He would kill people. Can you imagine peak 23-year-old Cam Newton roaming the middle of the field with his wingspan? It's literally Brian Urlacher. Remember, Urlacher was like 6'5". You could run a cover two with him because he just ate up the middle of the field. For me, this era, it's like peak Cam Newton because I can talk myself into him at like a lot of positions right now. And I even checked the hand size for a tight end.
Yeah, I think Cam Newton's the right answer. You know, because you'd want a quarterback, and it's hard. Like, you can get cute with like a Taysom Hill or something, or you know, like a George Kittle, and just don't throw it. But I think Cam, the optionality gives you and the strength is ridiculous. Soccer player 4738833 asks, on the open market, how much money would you give a running back who is guaranteed exactly 1 yard per carry, meaning you could always convert every third or fourth down and one? Ooh.
I mean, the Patriots did it for 10 years with Tom Brady, and he was taking under market value.
Let me put it this way. Would you spend a draft pick on a guy who's guaranteed a yard? This is so fun.
No, because I draft for upside, and 1 yard to me is not upside.
No, but you know, these seventh rounders are not going to keep around anyways. You have a guy on your roster you know is going to get you third and one.
It's guaranteed. It's like he's an X-Men and his superpower.
It's a glitch. It's basically it's like a glitch in the game. Yeah, of course he would.
So his Wolverine,
all you got to get
is that he gets 1 yard.
Because, because then every down on the field for you, every set of downs is 9 yards.
I would pull the data on this. I would guess teams in, but it's 9 yards, but you need to get those 9 yards to access him. So in terms of a superpower, like, it's like a really cool knife you have, but it's on your heel. And you gotta like think of a way to position yourself to use that knife to murder somebody.
It would completely, it's really weird. It would completely change the way you game plan.
Yes.
Too, in a very interesting way. Great question. All right.
Weird
Jay
question.
Snipe. All my questions are weird questions. Jay Snipe asks, ooh, this is a spicy one. Why is Drew Brees praised for winning one Super Bowl while Aaron Rodgers is criticized for winning only one Super Bowl?
Oy vey.
This is fun.
Is that true? That sounds sounds like right out of like a Twitter hive based on people's fan bases.
Please, first of all, that would absolutely be a topic on First Take. Having been on First Take would absolutely come by. So don't put this on Twitter only. And secondly, I actually noticed this felt to me like the first Saints playoff elimination where Brees really started getting heat.
You know what?
People noticed this time.
I think, Mina, is that there was a portion of Drew Brees' career where he was a compiler. I'll pull it up right here. 2005 through 2016, Drew Brees never joined the I Don't Throw Interceptions Club that Tom Brady and Aaron Rodgers founded, where you could be brilliant and completely mistake-free. Russell Wilson has joined it. Drew Brees threw at least 10 interceptions every single season. He has 237 over the course of his career. So I would argue that criticism of Rodgers is because people think Rodgers is in the GOAT conversation in terms of his peak skill set, whereas I think Drew Brees is in the second tier of that conversation. And he's more of a compiler. He's more of a guy where over the course of his career, the numbers added up. Eddie Murray did it in baseball. It's just one of those things where you're like, oh, really? That guy's got 600 home runs? Yeah. Yeah, he's a pretty good player.
Right. When he broke the record at the end of the regular season, you started to hear a little bit of, huh, how come we don't talk about Drew Brees and the GOAT? And then when the playoffs happened, you started to hear, that's why you don't talk about Drew Brees and the GOAT conversation, both of which I feel like are probably, you know, not right.
And by the way, there's also something that you can't escape with Drew Brees. It's that, you know, all the credit for overcoming the shoulder injury that, you know, mm-hmm. 2004, 2005, we thought that might be it. But again, I also can't escape the idea that Sean Payton unlocked this guy. And because their careers run concurrently and, you know, I mean, Taysom Hill goes out there and things, you're like, there's a lot of thought around the league that if the guy's playing quarterback for Sean Payton, he's going to be pretty good. So, I don't know. I mean, it's interesting because the Rodgers, the whole conversation around his time in Green Bay, meaning he was doing amazing things, statistically amazing things, and winning a lot. And a lot of people believed that it was in spite of his coach. And I think with Drew Brees, we think it's a lot more because of his head coach. And maybe that's just...
And it's interesting this season, right?
Yes.
The Rodgers thing this season has kind of become an interesting reverse referendum, especially as Rodgers struggled in the second half on Mike McCarthy.
Oh, you bet. I mean, the 2018 Packers averaged 25.3 points a game. The 2019 Packers averaged 25.3 points per game. I mean, you can't write that better.
Last question, and this is a good one for you because you host a draft podcast that I encourage everyone to subscribe to. It's not about the draft, though. It sort of is. Pigpen91 wants to know if we think the Raiders will hold on to Derek Carr on their move or shop around and draft a quarterback. So this to me is fascinating because if you had asked me this halfway through the season, I would have said Derek Carr is the guy, no question.
Right.
But he really tailed off towards the end of the season, and he tailed off in a way that kind of confirmed all of the criticism of him, the risk aversion, I think some of the, I don't want to say mental, risk aversion kind of captures all of it, quite frankly. In a way that makes me feel like it might be uninspiring if they stick with him. So I would not personally, I'll answer first. I think they're going to bring in some competition. I don't think they're going to drop Carr, but I do think they're going to consider someone else.
Yeah, I'm right with you. You know, just to put the situation in context, Derek Carr, you know, he's had a season where I believe he was second in MVP voting, Mina. So he's shown some high peaks. The question is like, when he's not, you know, when he's not there, you just don't know what you have. I actually, thinking back to what Gruden has done in his career, I actually think it's highly possible that they keep Carr, even though he's only a $5 million dead cap hit, if they let him go. And they also bring in, like, legit competition, either through the draft or in a free agency period where there's just a lot of names out there. If you think a name like Andy Dalton is crazy, like, why? We're talking about Ryan Tannehill and MVP discussions right now, people. Like, and, you know, one thing I'll say about this is people don't remember this. I barely do. But if you think back to Gruden's career, he had an incredible breakthrough in Oakland when he brings back Rich Gannon, who's in like, I don't know, he's like 34 and 35, and he takes him to an MVP season. Gannon was 37, and he takes him to an MVP season.
I've been thinking, like, okay, other than a draft, are there any potential free agents out there that Gruden, in particular, given his proclivities,
right,
might be interested in? Like, would he go for a Phil Rivers, perhaps?
I mean, I'll just say this. I know for a fact, I'm not betraying anything here. Like, Gruden loved Marcus Mariota during that draft. He loved his preparation. I remember talking to John, like, during the pre-draft process about, he was like, you know, I had him down for QB camp, and the guy he took 25 pages of notes. So,
and that would be a great guy to bring in. I mean, it's not going to cost them a lot.
Right. If John's thinking at all about, you know what, I'd like to see what I could do with one of these guys that can move a little bit, that can steal some yards. I'd like to put in some more of these RPO concepts. I'd like to, you know, just do some of the stuff. Like, that's a shot. I mean, he could call up a Mariota and see what he has. I mean, the interesting thing about John is that he actually prepared, and I'm sure this has been out there, but he kind of like prepared for the NFL draft when he was doing it as a broadcaster, kind of like he was like, I wanted to be able to know if I could draft some of these guys. And you know, the quarterback stuff was real. You know, it was on TV and you'd cut it down to 30 minutes, but it was real. It was 7 and 8 hours over a couple of days where he really like chewed the bread with these guys and got into it. And so it's interesting because you know this, but like, you're always like, how did that guy get a big free agent contract? And you go back and you're like, oh, they loved him in the draft. The Patriots love Stephon Gilmore and they think they could unlock something. And it would just be interesting. Mariota's one that pops up to me just because I know Gruden really liked him. But again, I don't know, but I know they're not going to have to go 4 years and $80 million to get Marcus Mariota on the roster.
All right. Thanks, Chris. We're going to have Mel on next.
See ya. I'm going to drive to a daycare center.
So for the AFC Championship, I am delighted to be joined by the legend, the guru, the expert, the savant, the swami. I'm not in front of a thesaurus
right now.
I'm running out of nouns.
The idiot.
Mel Kiper Jr.
Did some call me?
Along with Chris, co-hosts First Draft, which is a podcast you actually start listening to now to get ready for the draft. Mel is also a sad Baltimore Ravens fan. So he got a close-up look at the Tennessee Titans. And I want to talk to you really about the Titans defense first. And then we can talk about how they match up with the Chiefs offense, because that's truly going to be a thrilling matchup. I was blown away by the Titans defense in this game. I mean, we're talking a defense, Mel, that, you know, by most metrics, including Football Outsiders DVOA stat, was average at best during the regular season. I've praised their front seven, Jarrell Casey. I like their linebackers, one of whom, Jayon Brown, didn't even play in this game. And this is where I want to start with you. I did not see them dominating a very good Ravens offensive line to that extent.
No, I think they were solid against the run. They had been, but I think in this game, remember, Mark Ingram was iffy, and he had the calf injury, and you saw how that affected him. You saw Mark Andrews not 100% with a high ankle sprain. That impacted him on that first ball that could have been caught. In fact, was intercepted. That changed the whole complexion of the game early. So I think the injury issue on offense really impacted the Ravens. Obviously, Ingram was so key to what they did with Lamar running the football, and Andrews so critical. It's the number one go-to option. So you limit what they're getting out of those two, it hurts that offense. And then to see 59 attempts. Lamar was attempting 17 to 25 passes in most games, Mina. He was at 59 there. He was at 34 in a loss to Cleveland, 43 in a loss to Kansas City early in the year. I think it got away from Greg Roman. I think the game got away from him. And I think the pass attempts, you're not going to win throwing the ball 59 times if you're the Baltimore Ravens. That ain't happening. And they had plenty of opportunities to get back in this game numerous times and just could not make a play at critical moments. I would have kicked the field goal at 14-6 to get your team mentally in charge, get that fan base, and put pressure on Tennessee, knowing that a touchdown now and they're losing. You don't need a touchdown and two to tie it. But analytics kind of wins out with the Ravens, and that's what they go by. That's what they've kind of lived with, and I think that's what they died with a little bit in this game.
If you've been afraid all season on fourth down, it's, I think, understandable. I didn't love the call both times, really, you know, running inside, but I think you're really right to point out that sort of got away from their identity as a team. And I don't know how much of that was, you know, game script versus coaching decision making necessarily. But I think one thing I noticed again on the rewatch was, so during the game, Mel, in my preview about the Titans, I said, I love this front seven. The secondary is not good. After this game, I was like, when did the Titans secondary turn into the Legion of Boom? Like, when did Adoree Jackson become the best cover corner in football? And then when I rewatched it, I realized, yes, they were very good, but they were also in extremely advantageous situations, playing a ton of man on third and long, which, as you know, the Ravens just weren't in that position during the regular season. And what really struck me about it was not Lamar Jackson missing a ton of throws. He wasn't perfect in this game, but I felt this game really exposed the Ravens wide receivers because they could not separate at all.
Well, they're not. They've never been a receiver team. They're a tight end team. Yeah, you know, they're a Mark Andrews, Hayden Hurst, Nick Boyle blocking, getting the ball to Ingram, running the football, throwing it to him. Yeah, that's what they are. Hollywood Brown will catch a few. Snead maybe one or two. There were games where the receivers only caught four or five passes, and they were rolling up big numbers. This is a Lamar Jackson, Mark Andrews, Mark Ingram offense. Bottom line. And two of those three components were not 100%. Ingram not even close to 100%. And I think you look back, and I thought this going in. What do you have to do to Tennessee to beat them? You got to eliminate Derrick Henry in the second half because 75% of his yards came in the second half of games. So why would you eliminate you? Because you know if you're up by 14-17, Derrick Henry can't be a factor. So I thought going into halftime, if the Ravens were only winning by 3-7 or Tennessee had the lead, the Ravens were in a little bit of trouble. If the Ravens had a 10-17 point lead, they're in great shape. And unfortunately for the Ravens, it didn't happen. Tennessee had control. Derrick Henry was able to be a factor throughout the game. And I think moving forward, you want to spin it forward. What's the key to Kansas City and Mahomes? You know they're going to air it out all over the place. Get a lead. Get a significant lead. And then all of a sudden, Tennessee's a different football team.
I just don't think you can ever count out this Kansas City offense, which is, you know, the best left in the postseason. I felt so bad for Lonnie Johnson in the Houston game. You know, and it wasn't, he wasn't the only player. I mean, at one point they were doubling Kelce, but you just can't. There's so many playmakers in Kansas City that you want to double or bracket, and obviously you can't do that to more than one player. And I think it doesn't. You can take out Kelce in a game. You can take out Hill in a game. You can take out Hardman in a game. Someone else is going to eat, right? Now, in the past, when we've talked about Mahomes, Mel, you know, we've talked about the one thing you can do to stop him. I guess the way the Patriots had success last year was disguising their coverages, tricking him, which is really like, you know, the only way you can stop any great quarterback. And I do think if I had to give one, I don't know, reason to be optimistic about the Tennessee defense in this matchup is they're really good at that. Dean Pease, in particular, you know, is really, really good at coming up with creative blitzes, creative pressures, creative disguises, which actually didn't really do a ton in the Baltimore game. But I think that's something they could use in the Kansas City game to try to stop Mahomes. Because you're right, if they're up at halftime, it's probably over.
I would say it's over. Yeah, I would think if you can't have Henry, where, like I say, majority of his yards came in the second half, being able to pound at you, then they're in a lot, their receivers don't get a lot of separation. And then you get ball tipped, deflected, off some hands, intercepted, and when it goes from bad to worse. So, yeah, I agree with what you said about Dean Pease. I have great respect for him. So I'm in Baltimore. He's a phenomenal defensive coordinator. Hey, Brent Venables is a phenomenal defensive coordinator for Clemson, right? He mixes up things better than ever to anybody.
Yeah.
He gives you, he disguises, he changes things up. He
shocks
you.
It worked for a quarter. It worked.
Yeah, it worked for a quarter, quarter and a half, and it was all over. And that's what happens when you have Burrow in college and you have Mahomes in the NFL. Now, those two quarterbacks are special at their respective levels because you can't stop them. And again, for Tennessee, it's tough. They seem to have that it factor. They seem to, they have the it factor going for them. They're believing it. They're feeling it. But now you get Kansas City, who's a different entity entirely. Barring a horrible day where, like say, mistakes all over the place for Kansas City, and they really overlook, and I don't know how you overlook anybody. You underestimate whatever Tennessee. I don't know how that can happen based on what they did in Baltimore.
Point, yeah.
But, you know, Kansas City, if Andy Reid can't finish this off, and I'm a big Andy Reid fan. You know, I've known Andy for a long time. You know, this is the game, I'd say, for him personally, this is as must win as any game Andy Reid's had probably in his respective, in his entire career.
I want to talk about the Titans offense. Because they're really, what they did in the last game was really freaking weird. The fact that, you know, they were so outgained on yardage by your team. The fact that also, you know, they didn't have a single drive that went over 45 yards. They won that game because of turnovers and field position. Like, I know, yes, Derrick Henry was the star and he was phenomenal. You guys couldn't stop him. And I don't think Kansas City will have any trouble either. But ultimately, the Tennessee offense didn't have to do very much in the Ravens game. And you had, it was a combination, as you mentioned, you know, there's Derrick Henry, and also Ryan Tannehill hitting twice, one on a play action pass that I do not know how the Ravens defense didn't see coming. They sold it really well. It was like out of heavy. They had Henry deep, you know, in the backfield, but every single person I know is screaming at their TV, they're going to take a shot. And they did. And then that, insane pass to Jonnu Smith.
Yep.
And that, Mel, I think brings up the other thing that's so bonkers about this Titans offense, which is they're scoring every time they're in the red zone. Now, historically, which is the other reason I would say, aside from turnovers, that they won, that's not usually sustainable. So I want to ask you what you think about, you know, having seen this Titans offense, having seen how successful they've been since letting Tannehill take over in the red zone, do you think they can keep it up?
I'm not going to say they can't. I mean, what they did in this game was, I think, reflective of great coaching and situational football, seeing that we got a third down, throw it up in the end zone. And they did, and Smith made a great catch. It was a phenomenal catch. And then after you get the fourth down stop, as you said, what happens? Sudden change. You get out there, you stop them, your defense is let down, and you go for the jugular. You say, I'm going to air it out deep, and Humphrey got beat, and there you go. Touchdown. Boom. So again, every time they had to make one key play, they did. The third and 12, touchdown pass. Great catch. Coming out after the fourth down stop, boom, touchdown pass. Ravens, fourth and one, stuffed. Okay. Every time one team had to make a play, the Titans did. When the time the other team had to make a play, they didn't. And again, it was a rare game from that standpoint where not one point in time, Ravens can make the big play to Hollywood Brown. They got all that time. They have 11 seconds, right? Before the half. You think, okay, we're going to get a couple shots at the end zone. Lamar takes 8 seconds, throws it away. You got to kick the field goal. Quick pass would have gotten you one or two. Instead, killed 8 seconds. The field goal, come out in the second half. You think you can tie the game or get back in it. You're stuffed on fourth down again, and you don't kick the field goal to make it 14-9. So again, I mean, it was one of, if I said to you, how many carries did the Ravens running backs have in that game? You would say, maybe 15 to 20, right?
Yeah.
The Ravens running backs carried the ball 9 times.
Wow.
That's not going to win a game. Lamar carried it 20. Lamar threw 59 passes. That's not a formula for success with the Ravens. And again, if Ingram's healthy and Andrews is healthy, we know it's a different football
game.
But hey,
yeah,
football's a game of injuries, and the Ravens weren't able to overcome it. And some of that was, I think, the game getting away from their offensive staff.
What do you make of Ryan Tannehill? So if you're listening to this, I'm sure you know that Mel is the world's preeminent draft guru. And I imagine you've been watching him for a very long time.
Mm-hmm.
It's just so wild and so unusual to see a quarterback like that not only, I think, have a turnaround or a streak later in his career. He's, I think, 30 or 31. But to do it over a sustained period, right? Because Tannehill has the one good game. Everyone's like, okay, cool. Yeah, Ryan Tannehill, he's athletic. And he looks pretty good. He looks like he did his second year. Oh, wow, another one. Okay, all right, great. So he puts together this string of incredible performances. The playoffs come. He has yet to throw the ball over 100 yards because he doesn't have to, okay? I personally think he's going to have to more in the Chiefs game. I mean, in the Ravens game, if you guys hadn't turned it over, I do not think their offensive formula would have been nearly as successful. Like I said, they had very short fields to work with. But I think they're going to need a lot more from Tannehill in this game. What do you make of him at this point, Mel?
Well, wide receiver. He was just a brilliant athlete. As a quarterback, you knew there was going to be he was a kind of a work in progress. And unfortunately, what happened with Ryan Tannehill was injuries.
Yeah.
And with the wrong team, the wrong organization, the supporting cast, whatever, he just couldn't stay healthy. And again, when he was able to be 100%, he had some good performances. He showed promise. It wasn't like he was awful. It wasn't like you would say he's this catastrophic bust, but again, here he is. He went to the right team. He picked the perfect spot to go to, knowing that Mariota was kind of there, but they were waiting to see, could he get over the hump, and he couldn't, and he seized the day. And I look back and I say, okay, there are quarterbacks again, like Trent Dilfer did, that seized that opportunity. Came to Baltimore, had been written off. It was a former early first-round pick, was a Pro Bowl quarterback 1 year in Tampa Bay, had his moments, came here, and boom. Now, I'm not saying they're going to definitely beat Kansas City because of that and say this is just Tennessee's year to do it, and they're going to go on and win a Super Bowl over the 49ers or the Packers. But what he's done is kind of brings back memories of that. But he's a great athlete. He's been an accurate passer. He's given his receivers a chance. He's thrown into tight windows because going in this game, you didn't see the receivers of Tennessee get a lot of separation. Mm-hmm. They get yards after the catch, but not a lot of separation initially and down the field. So I give him a lot of credit. But again, when he came in, he had nothing to lose. He was coming in for a struggling quarterback. He gave him a lift, and he's out there playing with house money. He really is.
Yeah.
He's playing with house money, and he's saying, hey, let it roll.
The team is, really.
Exactly. They are. And I think Tannehill is the front and center to that attitude and that approach. And how when you're free and easy, saw Rabel hooping up on the sidelines before the game, laughing, hugging, yeah. getting congratulated for what you, he said, hey, I'm not ready to congratulate and be congratulated for what I've accomplished. We're moving on. And you could almost sense he felt like they were moving on. They're feeling it from a coaching staff to a player. All the players on that roster, they are feeling it. That energy is unbelievable. That'll take you a long way. And all I can say for Kansas City, and Andy Reid knows this, you better bring your A game, because this Tennessee team, to say they're dangerous now is the master of the obvious, but what they've accomplished, that's why the NFL, that's why you play the games. That's what Boomer always said. That's why they play the games. And who would have predicted this, back in midseason? Who would have predicted this going into the playoffs? And to see where the Tennessee is right now, give them a lot of credit for what they accomplished.
Part of the reason I'm optimistic about their red zone success, even though, like I was saying earlier, it's really hard to sustain what they have. Bill Barnwell, the great Bill Barnwell, mm-hmm. Came on ESPN Daily and talked about how, like, during the regular season, during Tannehill's stretch, they were the second place red zone team, I think it was the Bucks, was closer to the 16th place team than they were to the Titans. That's how mm-hmm. good they've been. Now, part of the reason why I think they can perhaps sustain this in this game and going forward is, it's really, like, yes, Derrick Henry is great. They have a lot of athletes, I think, who give you big mismatches, and Jonnu Smith and A.J. Brown. But really, the receivers, like, A.J. Brown has not yet been a factor in the postseason, right? And I think he's remarkable. So it almost feels like there's some upside in the passing game. I watched the Chiefs' pass defense last weekend with a lot of interest, because the Chiefs' defense was the weakness. That's what got him out of the playoffs last year. And over the course of this regular season, they improved a lot as the year went on, especially the pass defense. Both the pass rush, Frank Clark, who was sick and injured and kind of a non-factor early in the season, really came on later. And then the secondary itself, under new defensive coordinator Steve Spagnuolo, mm-hmm. just looked a lot better. The different scheme, talked about that last week. Then they lost the rookie Juan Thornhill, did you like him a lot out of?
Okay. Yeah, like Juan. Juan has done everything. He played corner, safety here with the Cavaliers. You know, he's very good for today's NFL with his versatility, but they're fifth best defense in opponent passer rating. So you're right. I mean, they did, under Spagnuolo, get the job done in that area.
So they lost him in the finale. I was very deeply concerned by that. And I thought Armani Watts was going to replace him, but I think it was Kendall Fuller came out at the start. I watched the whole game just kind of watching how they handled Will Fuller. And they looked fine. Tavarius Ward, who's one of the corners, screwed up a few times early on. I think the big Kenny Stills catch was on him. But it felt like as the game went on, the Chiefs secondary looked more like they did during the regular season. I mean, Tyrann Mathieu, definitely one of the best defensive players in football. I think this Chiefs defense, Mel, is probably the best they've had in a few years.
Yeah, and I think Chris Jones, remember, he was hurt for the Houston game.
He didn't get me out.
No sacks, didn't play in that first Houston game. Of course, a little banged up coming in. But you think about Mathieu and Clark getting after it. I think when you look at this defense, yes, it's improved. We look at that. The one thing you can do, as I say, is run on Kansas City. So, again, can Tennessee? And one thing Tennessee, which John talked about, is protecting Tannehill. That's been an issue. And I give Ryan a lot of credit. He's looked down that gun barrel, as Jaws always said. Looked down that gun barrel and made throws and take hit after hit. He's had to do that.
He holds on to the ball way too long.
Well, he does, but that offensive line has had some struggles along the way. And if you get them in the second half where they're down by 14-20, good luck.
I want to talk about the Titans really quickly to wrap this up, because I do think they deserve credit, not only, I think, for the incredible defensive game plan, Henry, the execution along the lines, but just how this team was built. You analyzed the draft very closely. I mean, I was just watching this game. I mentioned Adoree Jackson, Rashawn Evans, Jeffrey Simmons, who, fell to them mm-hmm. because of an injury and also because of the incident where he hit a woman in college. There were a couple reasons why they got him at like 19 or mm-hmm. something, and they sort of registered him. Mm-hmm. But also just draft picks from previous years, Kevin Byard, Jayon Brown, Landry, Jonnu Smith. I mean, this is a homegrown team that John Robinson, the GM, made, well, I think a couple really incredible offseason moves in trading for Ryan Tannehill and signing Roger Saffold at left guard. And it just all of those decisions to me, Mel, really showed during this game.
Yeah, and I think to go back to what happens to this team if they don't have Tannehill. What if they have to ride Mariota the whole year? Where are they at, Nina?
Not in the playoffs.
So when you talk MVP, if I'm talking MVP, a true MVP of the league, and I don't like giving awards before the the season's over. Why are we giving them regular season awards? You judge players on how they do in the biggest games, not the regular season. The biggest games where all the pressure is on you. Who is the ultimate winner? Not consolation prizes. I don't get into all that. Who actually won the big ones? And you give the awards at the end of the season. If you're going to separate a couple players, let's see who goes the furthest and does the best in the big spots. Ryan Tannehill is as much of an MVP as anybody in this league. Because without him, we can talk about all these other things. These other pieces were nothing until he stuck over. This was a vanilla team that didn't really have an identity. You got to be Henry, but there's Mariota, the former second pick overall. You know, he's there. And then Tannehill came in. Whether it was energy, whether it was more accurate, whatever it was, they caught lightning in a bottle with Tannehill, and he made it happen. Because without him, they're a mediocre at best football team, just going through, finishing out the year. Nobody's even caring about the Tennessee Titans. They're not even on anybody's radar. So all these other pieces kind of materialized because of number 17.
I agree with you, and that's why when people say, wow, Derrick Henry is, I mean, again, he's phenomenal, but look at his numbers before. you gotta have a quarterback. Sorry. All right. Well, we could keep talking about that for a while. Let's just wrap it up here. Mm-hmm. Who you got?
You know, I think it's going to be Kansas City. I cannot in any way figure a reason for Andy Reid and Kansas City not to be in the Super Bowl this year. I just think Mahomes is going to outscore you. Tennessee will try to keep doing what that formula suggested they need to do. And Tannehill, I don't think he's going to have a horrible game. But I think when you're extended, you're not throwing 14 passes like you did against the Ravens, and now it's more in your hands. I just think Kansas City, I'm going to go, it's like same thing with Burrow. And nobody's outscoring them. They're going to put points on the board. They can get matchups you cannot handle. I'll go Kansas City there. I just think there's no way Andy Reid's being stopped this year. He was stopped last year by an offsides penalty, right? Remember that offsides penalty with D Ford? One mistake cost them a chance, and I don't think we're going to see that happen in this game.
Let's do some questions.
And now it's time for Dinks and Dunks. I'm getting paid for this, right?
Question number one. These are really going to be mostly draft questions because I got the expert in the house. If you're the Bengals, do you take all of the Dolphins' first-round picks this year and next year for Joe Burrow? Answer the question, Mel.
All the draft picks.
So
yes.
All the first round picks. Only the first rounders. First rounders this year, and then whatever is next year.
Okay, yeah. I think you would not argue with that. I don't think that's going to happen, because Miami has a chance at five to get Tua or Herbert. So you're not going to give up that. Keep in mind, Mina,
Herbert
one thing about Joe Burrow. Everybody is not sold on Joe Burrow.
That's crazy.
I was on the TV yesterday. Mike Tannenbaum, former GM, said, he doesn't like Burrow. From the fact that he's, only a one-year guy.
What?
Can he hold up for 16 games with that frame? There's debate about that. He had a fifth to seventh round grade going into the year.
Oh,
so again, there's going to be skeptics and doubters. Okay. Tim Hasselbeck, others. There's going to be skeptics and doubters out there that wonder, and they were saying Trevor Lawrence is so much better than Joe Burrow. Did Trevor Lawrence look so much better than Joe Burrow last night?
Jesus.
So again, that's why you get all these different opinions, and everybody has it, and we respect all of them, Mina, but to say that there's a consensus that Joe Burrow is elite of the elite and deserves to be the number one pick, it's not there. Do I think he should be, and he will be? Yes, I do. Well, so if I'm Cincinnati, you take Joe Burrow, and you roll with Joe Burrow for 15 years.
The question was, what about the trade? Do you say yes or no?
No.
You say no.
No, I don't think, first of all, I don't think they're going to offer it.
I know.
Miami can, first of all, Miami's not giving up all his picks for Joe Burrow. That's not happening.
We're just living in a hypothetical world.
Yeah, well, that's not happening. Not when you can get two at five or Herbert at five, and you have so many other areas of need where you put Joe Burrow. Think about this, Mina. Give up all those picks for Burrow, and Burrow's getting killed in Miami.
Yep, that's a good point. That's a good point, right? Because they need to rebuild that line.
They got so many needs.
Question number two. So we know it's probably going to be Burrow at one, Chase Young at two. Who does Detroit take with three?
Well, Jeff Okuda. would be a nice a starting point.
They have
point.
So many needs. So.
They do. They could go Isaiah Simmons, the linebacker from Clemson, who was all over the field in that first quarter for the Clemson Tigers. Did a great job all year, sacking the quarterback, intercepting passes, second in tackles, let him in tackles for loss. I mean, he's just perfect with that length and that ability to turn and run. He kind of flips those hips like a corner in coverage. Yeah, I think he's intriguing. Okuda, a corner, when you think about Stephon Gilmore in New England, you think about Tre'Davious White in Buffalo, Okuda will be expected to be one of the top two, three corners in the NFL. He'll tackle as well. We saw it with A.J. Terrell last night for Clemson, not tackling, but you saw Okuda consistently throw his body around, complete corner. That's why he's rated as high as he is.
Question number three. Mm-hmm. So obviously there's Burrow, there's Tua. Who's another quarterback you like that people aren't really talking about?
Well, I don't think they're talking about Justin Herbert a lot. Jacob Eason's probably the one that would be down a little bit further out of Washington.
I'm a Huskies fan.
Who's a big, strong arm kid, but he, you know, will run a little hot and cold. Decision making at times is a little questionable, but somebody's going to take him in the first round. I think you can mark that down. Somebody will take him in the first round.
Get even weirder for us though. Like, who's one who know what, like, who the average Joe hasn't heard, you know, maybe.
Well,
know.
I mean.
Not someone who's going to go high, just someone you like.
Well, I don't really like some of those guys have to say they're going to be that good.
It's
not somebody I can say I can really like that much. I mean, Jordan Love, Utah State's a second round pick who lost a lot of his key supporting cast and didn't have the year expected. Anthony Gordon at Washington State. Do you think he's going to be like Minshew or is going to be like Falk and the guys that came out of that program? That's a Chris Sproul scouting report. Chris scouts Washington State players more than anybody. So, I mean, I rely on Sproul for the Washington State Cougar type of guys. Steven Montez at Colorado, if you're looking to get for talent, from a talent standpoint, Steven Montez has ability. And he's the kind of guy you get in the fifth, sixth, seventh round that you can bring in. You know he's got the size, the arm, the mobility. If he can just become more consistent, if all the guys I mentioned, I would probably say Montez.
That's a good one. I like that one. That's a spicy one. Question four. I know you eat pumpkin pie every day for breakfast.
Yes.
How has it affected your health?
Well, you say, well, how much sugar, right? My wife, Kim, says it's too much sugar. Well, guess what? I don't eat the crust. You know that, Mina.
Wait. So you're just eating pumpkin pie filling.
And fat-free whipped cream with it.
That's so weird.
Okay, it's weird. You'll love this, Mina. We go to this restaurant, right? And the waitress who knows us, I always say, give me, you know, the meatloaf and the mash and gravy over everything. And then give me a little side of French fries with no salt. And she looks at me, are you crazy? You want no salt on the fries? You're getting all this gravy. What do you think's in this gravy? You know, what do you think that gravy's loaded with? But that's me, because I'm a contradiction, right? I'm a big contradiction. But, you know, the pumpkin pie, that's where all the hydrogenated oils are, is in the crust. Okay, just remember that from a health standpoint.
Okay.
All the hydrogenated oils are in that crust. Yes, there's sugar in that pumpkin, okay, the part of the pie we all love. But, hey, that's the only sugar I get all day. I don't put sugar in coffee. I don't put sugar in anything else. I don't drink sweet tea. Okay, I drink regular iced tea. So I need sugar some way, Mina, and I get it through my pumpkin pie.
That is fascinating.
And sometimes more than one piece a day, by the way.
How long have you been doing this?
I would say 25 years.
Oh, my God.
Mm-hmm.
What a fascinating, every day. Like, even though this is Monday through.
Well, I went through a stretch where the store we used to go to up in our old home didn't have pumpkin pie for whatever reason from May until September.
Whew.
And that was not easy.
You'd be furious.
That went to Tasty Cakes. Wow. But you don't know what a Tasty Cake is.
I know what a Tasty Cake is.
Do you?
That's worse.
It's a Philadelphia company. Yes, it is.
Yeah,
exactly. That's why I'm better off with pumpkin pie, right? But Tasty Cake. There's no, if you want the best cupcake in America, it's a Tasty Cake.
I'm still processing this. Okay, last question, as always, is from Lenny.
Uh-oh. This is tough, you say, right?
I don't write the questions. I just deliver.
Mm-hmm.
Big fan of First Draft. He says, you know, it helps him get caught up on his draft coverage. You know, he doesn't watch as much college football as NFL, being the host of this podcast. But he does want to know how it feels to be playing for second place to a podcast co-hosted by a dog. It's brutal.
I'm happy being number two to Lenny.